On the night of the 18th of June, 1963, my siblings and I gathered round the old Mullard valve radio in the kitchen of our house in Stonybatter. The British heavyweight champion at the time, Henry Cooper, or our hero Henry, as he was known to his Cockney fans, was facing a young American, Cassius Clay, at Wembley Stadium, who had rather cockily predicted that he would beat Cooper in 5 rounds. Over a crackly BBC signal, an excited Harry Carpenter set the scene for a memorable fight. I was 11. My elder brothers, Sean and Matt, had instilled in us a love of heavyweight boxing, which they'd received from our late father, himself in his youth an accomplished amateur. We could barely hear Harry's voice above the din of 50,000 fans, every one of whom, it seemed, was shouting for Cooper. We listened with amazement as Carpenter described Clay entering the ring with a fake crown on his head, proclaiming himself to be the king and the greatest. The bell sounded, and Cooper, who possessed the best left hook in the game, stalked Cassius for the first 2 rounds, catching him regularly. Clay's response was to tease Cooper by dropping his guard and inviting him to come forward. Cooper had very sharp bone structure, especially above his eyes, which meant that he cut very easy. Clay's manager, Angelo Dundee, had told Clay to exploit this. By the start of round 4, Cooper's eye was bleeding profusely. It was clear that he could not continue much longer. Then, out of nowhere, came the famous left hook, and Clay was on the canvas. The bell went after 2 seconds, and he was helped to his corner. Harry Carpenter was screaming above the crowd, "Clay doesn't know where he is!" The regular 60 seconds break was extended by the timekeeper to 65 seconds, clearly to the annoyance of the packed arena. But Clay came out and kept fighting. Round 5, just as he predicted, ended when the referee stopped the fight, with Carpenter proclaiming Cooper's injury the worst eye cut he had ever seen. Clay's prize for winning in Wembley was a match with the then world champion Sonny Liston, whom he knocked out in the first round, and so began the reign of the greatest fighter the world's ever known. My brothers and sisters and I would follow his career for decades, and like millions of people worldwide, learn not just to admire him as a great fighter, but also as a great human being, a civil rights advocate who gave a voice and hope to African Americans suffering under bitter racism. Little did I know that night in 1963 that 10 years later I would meet my hero, Muhammad Ali, as he would later be known. In the early 1970s, I was lucky enough to get a job as a trainee sound engineer in Avondale's studio. My duties included spinning discs and making tea for Larry Gogan and Gabe Byrne, Jimmy McGee, Mike Murphy, Val Joyce and other broadcasters at the time. I have great memories of Larry Gogan arriving with a box of discs under his arm and always a smile on his face. His timing was impeccable. And of course, there was the golden voice that was his trademark. Around this time, Muhammad Ali, at the pinnacle of his career, had been stripped of his title for refusing to serve in Vietnam. He was also refused a license to fight in the US, and because of that, a fight was arranged for Dublin, which would see Ali face a little-known boxer called Al Blue Lewis. A call came through to Avondale Studio asking us to record a radio ad with Ali to promote the fight. As Ali was busy training, someone would have to go to record him on location. You can imagine my mixture of horror and delight when Chief Engineer Paddy Gibbons handed me a TC-800 reel-to-reel tape recorder and a Grampian microphone and dispatched me to Croke Park to record one of the most famous people in the world. The fact that this will be my first ever location recording didn't help. When I arrived, I was sent to the handball alley at the back of the old Cusick stand. It was like entering a set from a 1940s movie, a smoke-filled room packed with press, camera crews, cut men, sparring partners and hangers-on. Ali was sparring with a punch bag held by his manager, Angelo Dundee. I was told to wait until they had finished. At last, I was called to the ringside. I then experienced a phenomenon that I'm sure I never will again. It was a blast of physical, tangible, powerful energy that was almost overpowering, yet radiating peace and happiness at the same time. It was like being in the presence of a colossal Greek god. I pressed record, praying that everything was in order. I had to stretch to get the mic near to him. I handed him the piece of paper with the script on it. He paused to read it, then looked at me with that well-known Muhammad Ali wry smile and stare. "You ready?" he said. "I'm going to float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. The Evening Herald is the paper for me. It's the greatest." And the greatest is what he was. That day is burned in my memory. But every day of my long career in sound engineering that followed is special to me because of the fine, talented people I worked with. With the recent passing of so many of our radio stars, Gay Byrne, Marion Finucane, and now Larry Gogan, I feel how honoured and privileged I was to have walked a short part of the road with them. Their likes will not be seen again.
In the world I grew up in, the concept of decluttering was unknown. In our house, we had less than a dozen of anything, including cutlery and eggs. I knew exactly how many pairs of socks I had, and a new dress was a treasure I would try on often, but wear only for best. My mother knitted our woolens, and on the hearth was a red and black rag rug made with strips torn from an old coat. It fell to my father to mend our shoes, and a couple of times a year he'd bring out the iron last and assemble his paraphernalia of nails and rubber soles and heels, plus little kidney-shaped metal segs that extended the life of a heel even longer. What a pity none of us could tap dance. I never felt deprived, because why would you if you had enough? The motto, make do and mend, was one we lived by quite happily. So when did repairing things become quaint? No one in today's throwaway society dons a sock or sews on an elbow patch. In my childhood, there was a general expectation that furniture and kitchen appliances should last a lifetime. Deep down, I still feel that way. And I love my 35-year-old vacuum cleaner, although I accept that if my washing machine breaks down, it may cost more to repair it than to buy a new one. Built-in obsolescence has seen to that. Of course, not everything is disposable. We all still hope to repair major items. Cars, farm machinery, and electronic goods all come to mind. For a time back there, it looked as if big business would make it impossible for anything to be repaired other than by the original manufacturer. However, in both the USA and in Europe, right-to-repair legislators have brought in measures so that your local mechanic and electronics repair shop get a fair crack of the whip. As we become increasingly aware of the damage our non-stop consumption is causing, there's a recognition that we need to recycle, reuse, and repair. In 2009, the first repair cafe appeared in Amsterdam, and since then, around 1,500 repair cafes have sprung up worldwide. These are places where you can bring in your broken toaster and walk out with it under your arm, all fixed. Some places are stocked with tools, and people show you how to use them, while in others, volunteers donate their skills on your behalf. Instead of twiddling your thumbs while you're waiting, it is only decent to return the favour if you can. Perhaps you're handy with a sewing machine, or have a knack with bicycles. I'm not immune to the siren call of shopping, but I find the fix of buying new doesn't last long compared with the satisfaction of getting, say, your knife sharpened instead of throwing it away. If this is all sounding a bit worthy and preachy, perhaps you might like to hear about repairs that are the last word in beauty and, yes, glamour. The Japanese have a particular contribution to make to the whole repair idea. When a ceramic vessel is cracked, or even if a piece is missing, they repair it with liquid gold or liquid silver, or else a special urushi resin lacquer into which they've mixed powdered gold or silver or platinum. So when a crack in a tea bowl is repaired, the repair is not hidden, but made apparent and becomes a thing of beauty in itself. A golden zigzag runs down the bowl as if it's been touched by celestial lightning. This art is an ancient one dating back to the late 15th century. The story goes that Ashikaga Yoshimasa cracked his favourite tea bowl and sent it to China to be repaired. Alas, when it came back, the pieces were held together by big metal staples, which made it look as if a giant locust had clamped itself onto the vessel. Japanese craftsmen were stimulated to look for a more aesthetic way to repair, and they devised kintsugi, a word that translates as golden joinery. To the Japanese mind, repairing an object marks an event in its history and celebrates it, making it more precious. Kintsugi is similar in attitude to wabi-sabi, the Japanese philosophy of embracing the flawed. If we look at repairing in this light, we see it for the creative thing it is. My dad, in his messy old shed, stocked with hammers and rusty tins of odd washers and screws, could take a wobbly chair and make it as good as new. Better than new, because it now embodied his loving skill. He was doing more for the planet than we knew.
If I were a carpenter and you were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby?
Island of Oceans. Islands wear collars crocheted from waves, necklets of glitter, beaches like bolts of raw silk. They hear silence nibbled by wind, water dribbling in ditches, a tatter of gulls round a curragh out to haul pots, its faint putter. They're puckered appliqué, patches sewn to a bucking sea, tethered to the mainland by ferries. Islanders keep their islands pinned to their hearts, secular scapulars.
Walking across West Cork, it is impossible to escape the violent legacy of the War of Independence. The memorials to the fallen stand proudly in village squares and on gable ends to those soldiers of Warrior Igtrigger son Saoirse na hÉireann. Like most Irish families, my own can nod to an ancestor who took part in the war itself, although you won't find any memorials to him. He was called Patrick O'Connor and he was a policeman. Since its inception in 1814, some 85,000 Irish men served in the Royal Irish Constabulary, the Irish police force outside of Dublin. The job was hardly highly paid, a constable making just over £1 a week in 1920, slightly more than the wages of a labourer during a full week of summer employment. But unlike the labourer's work, it was solid and constant. In a country so poor that young people often faced a choice of emigration or joining the British Army, the Royal Irish Constabulary was a rare thing, a solid wage that kept you at home. By 1920, though, those ordinary policemen were targets. The key to any successful war against the British, the IRA realised, was the intelligence network that the RIC represented. They were the listening ear across every parish, the Fianna Fáil, GAA and Catholic Church all in one, an invaluable asset to any government fighting a counterinsurgency campaign in the country. Towards the end of 1919, the IRA made their move, commanding all regional units to attack RIC barracks in their local areas within the month. In January 1920, they began. So successful were they that of the 1,299 barracks throughout the island, 434 were abandoned by April. By October 1920, 117 RIC members had been killed and 185 wounded. Over a three-month period during the same year, 600 RIC men resigned from the then force of 9,500. Patrick stayed on, although I can't say why. He would be forgiven for grabbing a one-way ticket for America and escaping the violence in Cork. He stayed where he was, stationed in Drimaleague in the west of the county, where, boosted by the Black and Tans, the police barracks remained open. And so his fate was sealed. On the first Tuesday of February 1921, an IRA volunteer named Ted O'Sullivan and five others took up position in the town. All were armed with rifles. When no one appeared, at 7 p.m. they sent off one of the group, Dan O'Driscoll, to find out if there were any RIC in the area. They soon heard that there were four drinking in Beamish's pub. They waited another 30 minutes until the men appeared, then opened fire, killing O'Connor and wounding another, a Constable Griffin. The two other policemen escaped. In the book Guerrilla Days in Ireland, Tom Barry mentions the incident in passing, saying that it was a Tan who was killed. O'Driscoll says the same. A party of Tans made their appearance in two pairs, he recounts, before opening fire. In the Irish military archives, you can find his testimony and that of other men and women involved in military engagements all across Ireland. Only O'Sullivan says that it was a policeman, something backed up by newspaper reports at the time, which also mention his death. Had men like O'Sullivan and O'Driscoll not succeeded, I think Ireland would probably not have become the independent state it did. There is a sense, of course, that it might have been achieved by more peaceful means. But by then, Ireland was on a violent path that it could not divert itself from. There was always a rumour that the IRA paid compensation to our family when Patrick was killed, but this seems unlikely. He was, after all, a legitimate target in their eyes. He was laid to rest in secret where his father, also a policeman, would also be buried, with no headstone, an Irish Catholic from County Mayo killed by other Irishmen. 6 months later, my own grandmother was born, but she was well into her 80s before she realised that in being called Patricia, she was named for her dead uncle. The incident was largely forgotten by my family, and I feel far enough removed by time and place to be connected to it in any way emotionally. However, each morning on Kildare Street, walking by the National Library, Doyle, and all those institutions that give our state force, I do hope that there is enough room in our national consciousness for the memories of all the fallen, no matter what side they were on.
Slender as a wand, she seems like a figure from another era, dressed for performance as always in a spectacular ball gown that makes her look ready for presentation at court. Veronica McSweeney glides gracefully to the Steinway grand piano on the stage of the National Concert Hall. Her ash blonde hair perfectly coiffed away from her unlined face, her long neck adding to the impression of repose. It's impossible to believe that this remarkable artist is celebrating her 80th birthday with a special recital sharing with a dazzling array of artists led by fellow concert pianist and longtime friend John O'Connor. John's involvement is more than coincidental. The recital proceeds will go to support the Dublin International Piano Competition, always in need of cash, and which John O'Connor founded. Veronica has also been one of the judges at several of the competitions. But there was a time a few years ago when the much admired Veronica McSweeney disappeared from public view. She was unable to play, her spirit ravaged, her fingers numbed into inaction. Her beloved elder daughter Judy, also a pianist, died in 2012. It had been a long and tragic progress from 2006 when she received a head injury in a car accident. After surgery to insert a shunt in her head, she finally collapsed, and after being in an induced coma for 3 months, she died from meningitis. She was only 44. To this day, her mother's beautiful music room at home in Wicklow is a shrine to Judy's memory, but for several years, the piano was silent. But there is solace too, reminders that music will always break through. Because although Veronica's son Carl is not a musician, her younger daughter Aisling is a violinist with the Scottish Chamber Orchestra and often joins her mother in performance. And Aisling was among the lineup for the soaring, romantic programme for the 80th birthday celebration on Tuesday. It was a long journey for Veronica to bring herself to play again, but in recent years she has been heard more frequently, building an audience that had never ceased to mourn her disappearance from the musical scene. An outstanding student of her time, Veronica McSweeney gained the patronage of the late Sir Robert and Lady Mayor, and after Dublin's Municipal School, she studied in London and Salzburg. She toured widely and settled in Manchester after the divorce from her first husband, the tenor Michael O'Dea. She lived there for 16 years, and while performing on a cruise ship, she met a further romantic fate when the ship's captain, Chris Sample, a Yorkshireman, fell for her and they married. That was in 1988, and Veronica soon discovered that she'd married a man with a passion for Ireland. The result was they moved back to Ireland to an idyllic hillside house in County Wicklow. Chris died tragically in 2017 after severe spinal problems followed by cancer. This time, tragedy didn't interrupt his wife's art. Having fought her way out of silence, Veronica has found solace in her piano and has continued to perform, combining it with caring for Chris during his long and painful illness. Tearing from rehearsal to teaching engagement, long legs flying, and getting literally hands down and dirty caring for her magnificent garden. Thank the Lord, one thing I have is plenty of energy, she says with typical understatement. Veronica McSweeney seems to have a briskly practical exterior, belied by her almost ethereal seeming fragility. But the romance of the musician's soul is never very far from the surface. Describing the programme for that very special recital as gorgeous, she said, I just have to enjoy it. She also expressed a fervent wish that each of the pieces was firmly cemented in place. The audience had no doubt when they heard them. Beginning with Mozart's Quartet in G minor, going through a Chopin nocturne, Debussy's Garden in the Rain, four of Bizet's Jeux d'enfants, Schubert's exquisite Shepherd on the Rock, Benjamin Goddard's Angels Guard Thee, and finishing with the thundering flourish of Shostakovich's Tarantella on two pianos with John, and with support and contribution from daughter Aisling, Carla Vedras on viola, Violetta Muth on cello, John Finucane on clarinet, and Virginia Kerr's wonderful soprano voice, as well as the inimitable O'Connor. This was an evening to embrace unsurpassed beauty, and it centred, let us not forget, on a beauty who was celebrating her 80th birthday.
Mom. Mom!
What?
My 7-year-old Tomo was putting his shoes on in the front hall, door wide open as I loaded the car. Come here, I've something important to tell you. It could be anything. You never know with Tom. I walked over. What is it? We're late. They say that having children later in life keeps you young. It doesn't. It just makes you do things that are meant for younger people, like running about after small humans that are faster and smarter than you, and caring enough about what other mothers think of you to apply lipstick before the school run. Mum, he raised his eyebrows mischievously, your youth is behind you. What's behind me? Your youth, it's behind you, he said, then smiled broadly. Tom loves to play with words, which is not always a good thing. Did you hear that? I said to his dad. Niall shrugged and smiled apologetically. Well, he said. Ugh, I said, and threw child, handbag and self into the car. I got another proper taste of youth later in the week when my 14-year-old niece Rosie came to stay. In the past few months, she's gone from being a tall, sporty girl in braces into an Instagram supermodel. Like her older sister, Lauren, Rosie is a natural beauty. But what is turning her into a full-on Bobby Dazzler is her ability to apply cosmetics. Like most girls of her generation, Rosie can now apply her makeup to a professional standard. When I was a young woman, I edited women's magazines, and part of my job was overseeing photo shoots. I was one of a small elite of women who knew about the finer details of makeup application, things like shading and primer and using highlighter pencils to make your eyes pop. Now, every 13-year-old girl with access to YouTube knows more than me. Life is one big photo shoot, and everyone under 25 is photo ready 24/7. It's weird, but I kind of like it. Let's all show off, why the hell not? So during a breakfast conversation with Rosie about the importance of applying primer under your foundation, I asked if she'd like to put my makeup on for me. I need a new Facebook author pick, I explained. OMG, I would love that, she said. Within 5 minutes, our kitchen table was covered in boxes of paints and unctions, like a department store Mac outlet. For the next 40 minutes, my niece meticulously set about transforming me. Her huge blue eyes were serious with concentration as she tested colours of foundation on her hand and my cheek. Her young, slender fingers patted primer into the grooves of my face as she set about the challenge of improving her ageing auntie and turning me into my best self. What a responsibility. I didn't care if she turned me into Bobo the Clown. I was in heaven, just sitting there, the centre of her attention. Being close to my nieces feels like an even greater privilege than with my own sons, because their attention is not to be taken for granted. Rosie and Lauren's sweet natures make them universally adored, and I am at the end of a long queue for their love. Moments like this are rare nuggets of intimacy. Tomorrow, when she leaves, I will have to bite my tongue not to say, "Don't forget me," like a needy relative. When she was finished, Rosie proudly turned the mirror to me. Oh dear, I looked like a Liza Minnelli tribute drag act. "It's gorgeous," I said. Then we stood by the window. Rosie arched her eyebrows and did that slight pout the teenage girls all do and took a selfie of us both. When she showed me the result, I couldn't believe it. I looked like a flippin' young one. It was a photo of Rosie and her short, plump but young friend. In real life, I looked like I'd been dipped in a bag of cement, but on camera, I was a goddess. When I posted my new author picture on Facebook, it broke the internet with likes. People love a makeover. I know that from my magazine heyday. Rosie's mission was a success. Later that night, after I had taken it all off and was putting Tom to bed, he turned and said matter-of-factly, "Mum, you are so old, you might die." "I'm not old enough to die," I said, "not yet." He studied my face and said, "You're right. Granny has wrinkly cheeks. Your cheeks aren't wrinkly. Well, not very wrinkly." Then he looked down at my hands, which were holding his book, and said, "But your hands are quite old." No amount of primer and foundation will fix that, I thought. "You know what, Tom," I said, "my youth is behind me, but that's not necessarily a bad thing, because do you know why?" "Why?" he said, excited for my punchline. Sometimes when Tom smiles at me, I am so overwhelmed by the energy, the beautiful life in his glittering eyes, that I have to look away. It's hard to explain to a child how joy can make you cry, because it means I get to enjoy your youth instead. He didn't have an answer to that for a change.
On this morning's programme, we heard The Greatest by J.M. Dolan, then Mending Our Ways by Margaret Hickey. That was followed by Island Devotions, a poem by Geraldine Mitchell. After that, we heard Death in West Cork by Jodie Clark. And following that, Veronica McSweeney, How to Celebrate 8 Decades at the Piano by Emer O'Kelly. And finally, Your Youth is Behind You by Kate Kerrigan. This morning's music began with Stand By Me, sung by Benny King. That was followed by If I Were a Carpenter, sung by Johnny Cash and Joan Carter. After that, we heard Sarela Pala, Fire on the Island by Sibelius, sung by the Estonian Philharmonic Chamber Choir, conducted by Heikki Sapanen. After that, we heard the Kelly O'Riordan March by John Kelly and Sean O'Riordan, played by Eamon McGivney and John Kelly on fiddles and Padraig O'Riordan on accordion. And the final piece of music was Tarantella for Two Pianos by Shostakovich, played by Veronica McSweeney and John O'Connor at the National Concert Hall earlier this week.